Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 13th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon, we have Tom Soldner. Today's session number is 2004, and its title is Heirs According to Promise, Parents and Passions, Mapping Human Emotional Systems. Let's listen in.
For a previous session, I just put some things up here that says a little bit about the basics of family systems theory. You might want to glance at, and over here, the eight concepts. I'm not going to go through these today because we're going to focus mainly on leadership, and I think you'll be able to pick up the way family systems thinks about and talks about leadership. But that's for your reference. If you want to just take a peek at it, you may have a question about it somewhere along the line. Okay, I think we're ready to begin. My name's Tom Soldner. I work as an interim pastor and consultant to organizations in transition. Usually it's congregations, but sometimes nonprofit corporations, and usually in the state of Washington, sometimes Oregon, and occasionally back in the Midwest, but usually out in this part of the country. I studied with Edwin Friedman, who is one of the sort of pioneers in the area of family systems, and at his Center for Family Process in Bethesda, Maryland, for the past 4 years. I live in Spokane with my wife Linda, who is back there and celebrating her birthday today. And no one else knows that but us. And I wasn't supposed to mention it, but I thought I should, so other people can.
I shared her birthday with somebody that we were talking to about in the lift last night.
Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, there's a young girl with her, what's her name? I think it starts with him.
Couple birthdays. It must be a good day.
It's a good day.
Good day. I mentioned before, I put up some papers, some posters there that says a little bit about family emotional process, what the concepts are, and the basics of family systems. Essentially, in family systems, we're talking about thinking about human interaction and human relationships in terms of the functions that individuals carry out in systems. You think about it like the solar system. When these chunks of matter came close enough to one another, the gravitational pulls pulled them into an orbit, and there came to be a system. And now that system, what we call the solar system, controls the orbits of those pieces of matter, of the planets, more than the planets control the system. And so when human beings come into relationship with one another in families or other organizations, in churches, in businesses, and even in societies, a field is established between them. And that field controls the behavior and functions of individuals in that field more than the individuals control the field once it's established. And the key to dealing with that is for us to recognize that and as much as possible control our own functioning within that field. And oftentimes there's going to be pressures on us to do things differently than we think they should be done. And we'll talk a little bit about that too. That's what's called self-differentiation. Understanding who we are, where we end, and where others begin, and trying to be the self that we want to be and know ourselves to be, rather than being pulled in all sorts of different directions by other forces and other people in the system. I have noted in each session a book that I would recommend to you highly, Family Ties That Bind. This is by Dr. Ronald Richardson, and it talks about Family of Origin and Essentially the Principles of Family Systems. It's available in the bookstore, and I think you'd find it very helpful, very direct and simple explanation. There are three other books there that deal with family systems in relationship to, primarily in relationship with the church, but they're also helpful books and can give you a good background. The one other that I'd recommend is a little more expensive book. It's not in the bookstore, but it's by Roberta Gilbert, and it's called Extraordinary Relationships. I think it's also a very helpful and a little more involved, in-depth discussion of family systems. Some of you may be familiar with the books by Harriet Lerner, Dance of Anger, Dance of Intimacy, Dance of Deception, which is also a family systems approach to relationships. We want to talk about leadership today. I'd like to share with you a part of a videotape that Ed Friedman did before he died that talks about leadership. Before I do that, let me ask you, what is a leader when you think about leadership? What do you think of?
Someone who can get things done with other people involved in doing them.
Okay.
Somebody with good ideas.
An organizer. Visionary.
Okay. A lot of different things that we associate with leadership. If you think about Scripture, who do you think of as a leader in the Bible?
Moses.
David.
And what are the things, what are the characteristics of these people in Scripture that lead you to believe these are leaders? Do these things that you've mentioned about what a leader is apply to them?
Yeah. Okay. Moses wanted help. A lot of help.
Okay.
Yeah, but they can get it.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
Leaders usually want help too.
Yeah, that's what I mean, but they can get it. That's.
Yeah.
Jesus.
As you see this video clip, I'd like you to think about the things you've mentioned, and think about these persons you know in Scripture and their leadership, and see if the way Ed Friedman talks about leadership and the principles of leadership apply to these persons in Scripture you think of as leaders, or other people, you know, in the life of our nation, or your church life, whether what he says about leadership applies to the people and the ideas that you've suggested.
What I was thinking was about power. They have power, but they only have it because the people around let them have it.
Okay. I
mean, the people don't take it away from them.
Some people say that the most important thing about leaders is they have followers.
That's true.
They have a charisma. It's true. I think many of the great leaders have a certain charisma that others don't.
Well, let me start this.
Was it tell you what I thought?
I have been doing super vision for various professional people.
Can you hear that?
And this is really all out in professional. Physicians, nurses, lawyers, clergy, educators, and so on.
Dr. Edwin Friedman is a rabbi, a family therapist, and a consultant to professionals such as these community leaders. In 1985, Dr. Friedman wrote this book, Generation to Generation. In the book, he describes the similarities between the emotional processes that families experience and the problems of contemporary society.
I'm going to draw for you a rather unusual parallel. I'm going to suggest to you that the state of American civilization, the state, at least the emotional processes in American civilization, are strangely enough very similar to the emotional processes that existed in Europe before Columbus, the late Middle Ages, just before the Renaissance. All right? The Nuremberg Chronicle of 1492 described Europe as stuck. It described Europe as it's in the wake of the plague, the breakdown of the feudal order, the problems in the church, and the fact that Europe is totally encircled by the Moors and has no way out to the forest.
What got Europe unstuck was the daring adventure undertaken by Columbus, an event that catalyzed others and set the stage for the innovations that changed the way Europeans viewed the world and themselves.
In the wake of the discovery of America, you have the breakdown of the two major ideas that guided Europe for 1,500 years. One, that the Earth ended at the equator, and second, that we had a geocentric universe, that everything revolved around the Earth. Yet, Magellan's circumnavigation in 1522 and Copernicus is really within 20 years of that. All of this occurred within 50 years after the discovery of America.
Dr. Friedman sees the same things happening today, an imaginative gridlock that has caused contemporary society to become stuck.
When a system is stuck, it cannot get out of its problems by more thinking. Okay? It can only get out of its problems through adventure. That the great lesson of 1493 is that to unstick a system, people have to be willing to encounter serendipity.
Think about
they
families
to
with this too.
Because it is only when you encounter serendipity that you can come into contact with new issues and new questions which your brain can think up because of the way you phrase the problem to begin. And we are living in a society that is more focused on safety than adventure.
As in families, many of the problems in modern society stem from poor leadership. According to Dr. Friedman, contemporary leaders must learn to view problems in bold and innovative ways, as Columbus and the other great figures of the Renaissance did over 400 years ago.
Now that's the bottom line of where I'm coming from. If it shocks you, good. Because what I have to say this morning, and really most of today, is that our civilization is stuck. That what I see in traveling around the country is the exact same problem everywhere I go, and the problems exist no matter what the sociological characteristics of the institution. And every institution in America thinks its problems have to do either with its own institution or with the classical roles. So are we churches, are we synagogues, are we businesses, and so on. And as near as I can tell, the problem has to do with the way we think about things rather than our makeup or having the right technique. What I'm looking for is what is unchangeable, okay? What stays from generation to generation, to use the phrase? You know, what really stays in there and is something that, because if you find it, it's got to be universal. It will be just as true for men and women, blacks and whites, Jews and Christians, and the odds are it will be just as true for every generation if you go back to Adam. That's what I'm looking for. And this conference today is really going to be about leadership, but it's going to be about leadership in a different way than perhaps you're used to.
This program will present Dr. Friedman's ideas on how societies become stuck, the barriers that leaders must overcome, and the qualities leaders must possess to succeed.
Okay, I'm going to stop it there. There's been a lot of talk, you know, over the past few years about the whole matter of Columbus, quote, discovering, unquote, America, and the problems that arose from that around the 500th anniversary of that occurrence, some of the immorality that arose and the attitudes that arose as a result of that, and it played out through the ages. I want you to be clear about the fact that Friedman is not talking about that aspect, but is talking about the aspect of the spirit of adventure and the fact that Columbus had to take some enormous risks, essentially go the other way with things. And once he did that, as well as these other explorers, there came some great changes in Europe, what we know as the Renaissance. There are some sheets right there. If folks didn't get those, I'd like to refer to those for just a minute. Because we're not going to go through this. We mentioned these the other day, but for those of you who weren't there, we might take a look at this. He says, these are the signs of a stuck society. And they play themselves out both in families and in the society as a whole. First, in family reactivity. And by reactivity, he means in families that people in families are quick to interrupt each other. They finish each other's sentences. They label people with you positions rather than taking I positions, so that the climate is easily heated up in a family. The focus is usually on the latest crisis. And there's a disappearance of playfulness in relationships. In the society, it's a quickness to interfere in another's self-expression. Ad hominem arguments and epithets, attacking other people, overreaction to a perceived hurt. Or leaders are led by crisis. Leaders go from one crisis to the next crisis rather than taking proactive stances. He says the second characteristic is the herding instinct. And in families, that means people are stuck together and discourage dissent in the family, discourage people from having different opinions. People say feelings are more important than ideas, that peace is valued over progress or comfort over novelty. And there's an appeasement of the most troubled people, adaptation to weakness and sabotage. In society, it's relatively the same thing. There's a pressure for political correctness, people doing things the same way, and organizing around society's most dysfunctional elements. Another telling one, these aren't, I know, the ones exactly as put on your sheets, but you can get an idea from that. One of the most telling ones is that resources and programs are available for dysfunctional members of a society, not for the functional members of society. So you have a lot of programs for people who can't make it, but you don't have programs to encourage the growth and leadership of those who do have capacity. The third characteristic, he said, is blame displacement. We know what that is. In families, it's focusing on the problems, on pathology, rather than on strength. And then there's a displacement to other kinds of causes or problems. Well, money's the problem. We don't have enough money. Or sex becomes a problem between husband and wife. Or the in-laws are the problem. Or some institution out there is the problem. There's litigiousness and violence in society. It's the movement toward anti-incumbency. You know, it's their fault in D.C. It's their fault, the ones we've elected. Unwillingness of people to take responsibility. And then the focusing on problems, like not that these things are not problems, but it's focusing on those and not moving beyond them to say, what can each one of us do, but focusing on things, on carcinogens, or focusing on abuse, or even environmentalism. It's not that, you know, there are problems we have to face with those kinds of things, but focusing on them, talking about them, those kinds of things, without doing things, without taking stands personally. The fourth, he says, the characteristic is a quick fix mentality. In families are very impatient. There's a low threshold for pain, especially in anxious families. Reductionistic explanations are given. And people want certainty in families. In society, there are quick fixes too. The whole issue of assisted suicide in our society now, and that debate. Or efforts to amend the United States Constitution to get something done, to address a problem. People use drugs as a quick fix. Some hope that all of the gene study that's being done now is going to be a quick fix for our problems. People use religion, fundamentalism, give people answers. It's management that turns professionals into hacks, that is, people with gimmicks, rather than professionals who challenge people to grow. And finally, the fifth characteristic, he would say, is poorly defined leadership. And leaders are led by crisis after crisis. It doesn't say it on your sheet there, but that whole sheet talks about the kinds of things that leaders have to face and then take stands about and persevere in their leadership through these kinds of characteristics in a society or in a family. He goes on and talks a little bit also, as we did the other day, about some fallacies. He talks about the fallacy of empathy, that it's not that people shouldn't have empathy, but that it's challenging people to grow that helps people to grow. The fallacy of expertise, that if there's a problem, you can call in an expert who'll take care of it. And another version of that is, all I need is a little more information about it. You know, but we never catch up with the information explosion as it is now. We can continue getting more and more information. And finally, what it takes is some leader or someone to take a stand, to make a decision. The question is, when do we have enough information? Or when does a decision need to be made? And finally, the fallacy, he talks about the fallacy of self. We talk a lot about, well, we should be selfless in our attitudes toward others, or identifying self with, associating it with autocracy or narcissism. And what he said is, self is an important thing. We need to know who we are. And we need to develop a strong self so that we're able to take stands and move forward in leadership. Do you have any questions about those things? Think about the people you talked about in Scripture, the leaders. Did Moses have to face these kinds of characteristics in his society? chronically anxious people. They wanted a quick fix in the desert, right?
Yeah. So they got it.
The golden
dropped the bullet right out of the sky on them all the time until they were bored to death.
Well, and the golden calf was hopefully a quick fix. Was there any blame displacement in the wilderness?
Guess he didn't get to go in.
Yeah, it's Moses' fault, it's Aaron's fault or Miriam's fault, it's the leader's fault in any case. Jesus faced the same sorts of things during his ministry. And what was required for Moses, for Jesus, for leaders in Scripture, leaders in history as we know it, and leaders in families, because it's the same, is people who have vision, who can persevere in that vision over time. I want to finish, show a little bit more of this, and then we'll talk a little bit more about leadership.
To become separate from the group and yet still be able to lead it. Dr. Friedman believes that traditional approaches to leadership and management are misguided.
That all the efforts to train leaders which focus on identification, emulation, role modeling, and so on, are off base. What I came to realize is that most of the training that is done for business executives, clergy, and so on, is missing a really crucial variable. And that is, most of the training tries to get the leader to focus on them, and where I'm coming from is the leader should focus on him or herself. And that is the nature of the presence of the leader that affects the system, not the leader's know-how, not the leader's amount of data, and so on. Because when you start thinking that way, you come to realize that focus on issues of cultural diversity, focus on issues of gender, focus on issues of technique and so on, is absolutely irrelevant to leadership. It may have certain political usefulness, but when it comes to how a leadership functions, all those distinctions that the social sciences focus on, not only are irrelevant, they obscure the critical issues. And that's the bottom line of where I'm coming from. If it shocks you, good. What I'm trying to convey by this initial notion is we have all been taught that the important thing as leaders, whether you're functioning as a leader in an institution or in a family, is that we have to be good role models. I think that's nonsense. I think that just stresses leaders unbelievably. It just, if you think about it, good role models do not necessarily produce good followers. There's something else involved, something much deeper involved about the leader's functioning. And what the role modeling notion does is it stresses leaders. It makes us all think we have to be better and better, and we have to be good all the time, all the time. And I don't think it matters. I think what matters is how well differentiates the leader, because the differentiation of the leader affects the emotional process.
Dr. Friedman has done lecturing and consulting on leadership to a wide variety of groups, from religious leaders and secular ones, including business executives, government officials, and healthcare professionals.
I have personally found Dr. Friedman's theories very, very helpful to me. And I think helpful for, well, probably a number of ways. One is, there are some fundamental concepts that have helped me tremendously in my leadership. And what I'm talking about, those concepts are the importance of being well differentiated, the importance of staying in touch, and the importance of being a non-anxious presence. And as I've kept my focus on those concepts, it's been helpful for me in that I can identify my strengths, and also I'm very aware of where the weaknesses are.
It's not as though you provide an answer, or an answer that once you get it, you get it, and that's fixed. It's an ongoing way to think about yourself in the world, and the world itself. And I think that his curiosity and constant striving to understand things in a different way, regardless of what the rest of the world says about him or about the theory, is motivation to continue to do it. So it's both content, but it's also motivational to have someone who is really trying to make sense of the world from a different perspective. And I think that's what he's given me over these number of years, a way to think about the world and a way to operate in somewhat different way.
Being self-differentiated allows leaders to avoid entanglements in emotional triangles. An emotional triangle is made of three positions, A, B, and C. The key point to understand is that from position A, you can't change the relationship between B and C. If the person in position A, the leader, attempts to intervene in conflict between B and C, the result is that A usually winds up with the stress. Triangles work against differentiation. Leaders can modify tension by staying in touch with others in the group without getting caught in a triangle. The importance of self-differentiation may also be understood using the concept of field theory.
When people get together, they create emotional fields, emotional systems, and that emotional systems become the operating entities. Again, I've said this to you before, but just to put it in this context. That a field is an environment of force which can only come into existence when matter gets close to matter, like a gravitational field, an electromagnetic field. But once the field comes into existence, it has more power to influence the matter that brought it into existence than the matter can continue to influence the field. So the planets come together and they create a gravitational field. The sun, the planets, and so on. Once that field comes into existence, it determines the orbits. Far more than any orbit can determine the field. Everything is stuck in that. You can say similar things about transistors, you can say similar things about genes, and you can say similar things about people to the extent they are fully differentiated. So that the difference between people, transistors, genes, and all is not simply that they've got brains or self-awareness. It is, can they function in well-differentiated ways? So that differentiation almost becomes not being determined by the field. That's almost a definition of leadership. That my functioning will not be determined by the field. That doesn't mean I will ignore the field. That doesn't mean I will cut off from the field. That doesn't mean I will isolate myself from the field. But I will be aware enough of the field and myself and where I end and the field begins to know that I must pay attention to its influences on me.
In emotional fields, leaders have the capacity to see the field and decide how much they will let the field regulate their functioning. To be aware of oneself in relationship to the environment is another critical aspect in differentiated leadership.
One thing I do is to stay in touch. When I see people anxious, I communicate with them. I try to learn about the point of their anxiety, see if you respond to that. We had a major issue come up where people were concerned that maybe our organization wouldn't make it through this particular period. And I communicated with everybody, letting them know that I have great confidence we will, and here are some ways we can do it. That we have a strong board of directors that stands with us in this. So in part, I've communicated, I think, possibilities for the future that some may not see. And also, I think, just by my not becoming anxious in the middle of it, by, you know, when people come in contact with me, they're clear that I'm not worried as to whether we will survive or not. And I believe just how I am as a person probably does more than anything in terms of calming other people's anxiety.
Don't figure out what you stand for and what you think, regardless of how the important people in your life respond to it, is an ongoing process that takes rigor in your thinking and courage in your heart to know that it's what you think, and that while you don't want to be separate from other people, certainly your ideas will move you in the direction of them being your ideas and other people, and allowing other people to think the way they want to. So it's an ongoing process. It's not something you turn off and turn on. It is a way of knowing yourself and what you think.
Christopher Columbus, Ferdinand Magellan, Vasco da Gama, all great adventurers of the 15th and 16th century. They also provide good examples of the quality of leadership presented in this program.
There are things they all had in common, and what's intriguing to me is what they had in common are the exact same qualities that must exist in a leader before any other system can change. And the awareness of those factors is what informs all my consulting. I look for those factors and I try to promote them. What are they? The most obvious one is vision. By vision, I mean the capacity to see things differently from the way other people are seeing it. But here we go again. This is not an intellectual phenomenon, it is an emotional phenomenon, because in order to be able to see things differently, you must have some degree of separation from the people around you. The second thing is uncommon persistence. One of the most extraordinary things about Columbus is his persistence. Now, you could label it as craziness. You could say he wasn't persistent, he was compulsive. You know, and how do you distinguish it? And you could say, is hanging on to his vision, that's the same thing a psychotic person might do. And maybe the only difference between great discoverers and psychotic people is they turn out to be right. The third thing they all had, stamina. By stamina, I mean the capacity to deal with mutiny. Every one of those guys had a mutiny, and they hung in there. They were ruthless. But not in the sense that they used others, manipulated others, or destroyed others to get to where they want. They were ruthless, and I have that word in quotes, in that they didn't let relationships get in the way of their vision. Now that's not the same thing as saying you should be insensitive. What I'm saying is, when push came to shove, no matter how important other people were to them in getting to the goal, if those other people changed, they stayed with the goal rather than the relationship. The key to the kingdom in all leadership is beyond vision, stamina, persistence, and all that other stuff. It is being able to maintain a self-regulation in the face of time and not get thrown off course.
The qualities required for effective, well-differentiated leadership fly in the face of the tendency to have things remain the same. So much so that some people will attempt to undercut the efforts of those who are so bold as to be adventurous in the midst of anxiety.
Our need for one another is so great. Our tendency to adapt to one another is so automatic. The comfort that we feel in togetherness is so big that whenever anyone really important to us differentiates themselves and functions in a way in which they are less needy of us, we will automatically sabotage. The function of the sabotage is to bring back the togetherness, and the sabotage comes two ways: an undercutting of you or seduction.
Perhaps the best example that drives home the impact of stuckness, sabotage, anxiety, and consensus-seeking leadership can be taken from American history in the era just before the Civil War.
I got to thinking, that even though I have been an American history major, I don't think I was ever aware of how intense that conflict was, how deeply people felt on both sides, but also how incredibly reactive everybody was and how everybody was so involved in this thing. And I thought to myself, you know what this is like? This is like a family without well-differentiated leaders. And families that split often don't have that. So I decided to go back and do a little research on the five presidents before Lincoln.
The five men who occupied the White House before the Civil War were James Polk, Zachary Taylor, Millard Fillmore, Franklin Pierce, and James Buchanan. In Dr. Friedman's view, they rarely exemplify the qualities of leadership he promotes.
These five men generally were known as glad-handers, as compromisers. None of them wanted to succeed themselves. Every one of them was a compromise candidate for their own party. They were picked on like the 30th to 40th ballot. What I'm suggesting to you is that the Civil War was not the result of slavery and a whole lot of other political issues, but the failure of leadership in this country at the top. Because the way those guys functioned from 1840 to 1860 is exactly the same way leaders of families function best.
The point is that these five men lacked the qualities of bold and venturesome leadership with disastrous results. A war in which a million Americans were killed or wounded. Ironically, out of that conflict emerged a leader whom many would consider the greatest in our history. One who possessed presence, maturity, solitude, and stamina in shepherding the nation through its most dramatic and fundamental crisis. A leader who valued progress over peace. A leader who typifies the qualities of leadership that Dr. Friedman promotes. A message that more and more people find challenging.
Most systems change because either they bottom out or someone arises and moves toward the top, who is just able to supply vision and stay in there with stamina and not get overly reactive to the sabotage. My own view is most systems change because of some change in the leadership. Though I recognize that it's possible that systems can't choose those leaders. If there's a chicken or egg thing here, like I said, with regard to the Civil War and the presidents, that maybe a system could be so stuck it can't see clearly enough through to choose the kind of person to get them out of the problem. The major thing, the myth out there, again, to say what I'm saying is subversive, where the world is flat out there, is the assumption that a renaissance anywhere occurs because of information. I think that's one of the major prejudices of academia, and it affects all leadership training programs. The assumption that the way to change the system is get them more complete and more information, but the risk averse are not emboldened by data. What you need to have is a shift in the emotional processes. Sometimes that shift comes by accident and contact with another system and so on, but I think if you want to will that change to occur, that change in the emotional processes, it has to be in the leadership.
Mentioned the governor of Minnesota.
He is very self-differentiated.
As a well-differentiated leader.
Yep. And he certainly has stamina, and he's putting his names in there, and when he decides he wants something, he doesn't give up.
Yeah, we have one of those. It was Dixie Lee Ray. She spent most of her time with some kind of a hack in whatever machinery she was running. She went out and piloted a big ship into the Puget Sound and drove a big cat.
So what are you what are you saying or suggesting?
It's in the eye of the beholder, huh?
What did Friedman say? What did he say the characteristics were that were necessary?
Vision.
Vision, persistence, stamina, and self-regulation in the face of stamina. I mean, in the face of sabotage. Now let's look at the examples that you gave. How about vision? Does Jesse have vision?
No, Jesse.
I don't think so.
He may have a vision, did he?
What did he say he was going to do?
A vision for what, though?
Not be what most politicians have been.
Right.
He didn't say that. So he was
not a vision.
He was a yang and not a yin.
Mm-hmm. Negative.
How about Dixie Lee Ray? How many remember Dixie Lee?
I barely do.
Few.
Well, she just kind of, I think her goal was to be a guy. The best guy we had. And she kind of was. Well, I don't know.
We have to look, as far as Dixie Lee Ray is concerned, at persistence and stamina.
She was elected.
And those kinds of things. She was elected, but she didn't last long.
No.
I think Jesse has persistence and stamina. I mean, his persistence, I think he can make a decision that he's right in what he's going to do and nobody's going to interfere. And relationships.
He certainly doesn't get stuck on piling up too much information.
No.
Does it?
Well, he doesn't give out any information. You know, we're from Washington State. I've never heard anything about his vision at all.
I don't know what he's going to do is what
even
I
if he am religiously.
Yeah.
Let's what about the persons we mentioned in Scripture? In terms of vision, persistence, stamina, and self-regulation.
Our scriptural people, I keep thinking that the vision came from God through them. So I'm having a little hard time with that. Help me.
Yeah, me too.
What is the difficulty?
Well, I don't.
What is vision, a goal?
Vision was from God instead of from Moses. And that is God's vision through Moses.
Are you stuck because if you look at Abraham Lincoln, maybe that the parallel, you don't see? I mean, I'm just asking
the
question.
Well, he wasn't in the Bible, so I didn't attribute that one as much to God through Abraham.
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly it.
Mm-hmm. There you are.
But I mean, we'd have to ask the same question for leaders today and down through history. You know, we might ask the same question: was their vision from God? You know, and that may be true as well. We may be able to say that for a great many years.
Well, I think that if we go back to this idea of more emphasis on the Genesis 1, the creation type thinking, one aspect of a leader is they want to create a new reality somehow. So, for example, with your governor in Minnesota, I don't know near as much about him as you do, but he seems to have an idea of what kind of a society he wants to create, which is one that has less government and more individual self-realization, whether he puts it in those words or not. He does have a vision of what he wants. He may agree with it or he may not, but he has an idea of what kind of a world or state he wants to create. And of course, people who are all guilt-ridden and afraid they're going to make a mistake and lose their salvation are timid people. They don't go out in a creative way to be forceful and make change.
Well, you can look at someone like Martin Luther King, who started capitalizing on the vision that so many people had. He articulated it. He was persistent. He had stamina when the right-wing people wanted him to, when they put him in jail and all that. And he also had stamina when the left-wing people talked about violence. He said, no, our vision is the peaceful resolution, and we're going to accomplish this in a peaceful manner. And he carried on through that, even with all the incredible sabotage. Mm-hmm. And Moses, again, he had incredible sabotage. Like, he was, Friedman was talking about all his explorers when he talked about them facing a mutiny. To face the mutiny as Moses did, and to be persistent and carry on, he was an excellent leader.
Yeah, I think most of the ones we mentioned from the Bible would fit the profile.
Certainly, if we think about Jesus, had a vision why he was here, persistent stamina and self-regulation in the face of sabotage. He was sabotaged on every hand. And remember that sabotage is not only always a negative, undermining kind of thing, but it can also be a seduction, which was Satan's tactic in the wilderness, which was his disciples' tactic, the closer the cross drew.
You can do it to yourself, too. You just get right up to the point of doing something and then say, oh, well.
I think, how about families? Think about families, because it's the same. We're talking about leadership in systems. How does this work in families?
Can there be more than one leader?
What do you think?
There better be a shared vision, I guess, if there is. Mm.
Co-leaders of the children. I mean, if the family is a couple of adults leading children.
Mm-hmm. Up to a point.
If we suggest that health is promoted by self-differentiation, by people knowing themselves and by building a self, one hopes that in families, not only the parents, but the children learn about that too, and that parents are encouraging their children in the development of that self over time. And consequently, if that is the key also to leadership, then we would assume that at various times there would be leadership shifts in the family.
Under a possibly agreed-upon vision?
Wouldn't that be, that certainly would be the best. It'd be a real difficult kind of thing. So there.
Difficult, but maybe possible. Difficult, but maybe possible.
You mean a shared vision? Mm-hmm. Yes, I would say it has to be a shared vision, as some of you have suggested.
I think a lot of family leadership is working out that shared vision. Which takes all those other things on that list, too. Mm-hmm. Plus, I don't know, I don't see, well, I guess stamina is where the commitment comes in. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, what is it, if you have a shared vision, and if that sometimes is difficult, when you start talking about the shared vision in a family, and you know there are differences, what is the result of that? Little anxiety?
Yeah, a little.
People getting anxious. What happens when people are anxious?
They act out.
Reactivity? Mm-hmm. Those signs of a chronically anxious society we talked about? There's reactivity.
Blaming.
Blaming sometimes.
Indecision. Huh?
indecision? Hurting? There's always the appeal. Oh, let's not worry about this now. Let's just get together and feel good about it. Let's let this issue rest. And maybe giving up on following through, on, you know, being persistent. Or saying, looking for some way of taking care of it quick. You know, I heard of a wonderful tape series. And if we get this tape series and sit down together and listen to it, I heard about three families who had just did everything for them. Quick fix.
But that's not necessarily a bad thing to do. I mean, if you're working on a problem and you're really stuck, I think the beginning of the fix. Well, yeah. I mean, at least seeing somebody else's approach can really help. Or going to counseling. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of things that. And I wouldn't call that a quick fix. I call that like the beginning of something, maybe. Maybe not, too. Maybe they're hiding.
Well, oftentimes there's been a breakdown in the family system, and what the counselor does is restore communication, which is a step in the right direction, and hopefully they can learn the communication skills to be a healthier family.
What's the difference between this as a, that sort of thing as a quick fix, and as a contribution to the solution?
Communication, yeah.
Well,
or thinking that those films are going to give you the answer, and you don't have to look at it yourself.
Yeah.
That going, the suggestion you had of going and listening to tapes is like triangulating, of trying to get a buddy in the tape to work over the person who's been reluctant.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
And the other is that he keeps talking about when people don't want to be informed, giving them information is not helpful.
Well, it's not that information is bad. Information can be helpful. It's a matter of thinking that the more information you get, you know, is what's going to do it. The amount of information is going to make the difference. And that's not what makes the difference. So the other thing is to say, any kind of ongoing solution or ongoing health for a family is not something that happens in the short term. It happens over time, and there may be many different things that contribute to it. The minute we say, think of any of these things, whether it's counseling or whether it's a tape series or whether whatever, a new mattress for our bed, any of that kind of suggestion that'll take care of things in the short term is a quick fix. It's the quick fix mentality. And a lot of people have it in our society. I'm sorry, I was just going to say
about the data that I think that more information can be extremely helpful if you're clear about what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. You don't just collect data at random. Mm-hmm. But you need to know why you want it in order to make a decision.
And to recognize that at some point a decision needs to be made.
Yes.
And the time comes when a decision is more important than gathering more data. Let me mention a couple things. Leadership can also, particularly in anxious situations, acts as a step-down transformer for the anxiety. And if you've gone overseas and you have some 110 current appliances that you want to use, and it's 220 or 240 current, you need a little transformer so your things work. When there's high anxiety in a family, a leader can act as a transformer. Now, a leader can also be a step-up transformer.
Yeah.
If a leader gets reactive and anxious, then can increase the anxiety for the whole system. But hopefully a leader is a step-down transformer that reduces anxiety by his or her own
non-anxious presence, just the presence of that kind of person in the midst of a system can make a difference. It's not about gimmicks. It's not about doing this or that. It's about presence. I'd like to suggest a few things because we're close to running out of time. Principles for functioning. Principles of leaders for functioning in systems. One is keep up your functioning. That is, don't let a crisis or a number of crises determine what you're going to do or how you're going to do it. Keep up the kind of functioning and leadership that you're committed to providing. Keep the eye on the goal. Develop a support system outside of the system you're talking about providing leadership for. If it's family, you know, maybe a friend. If it's a work system, someone outside of that work system. Stay focused on the long-term goals. We've mentioned that a couple of times. That, it seems to me, is one of the most helpful times for prayer, meditation, deep breathing. I mean, whatever allows us to step back a minute outside of the anxiety and helps us, again, get a perspective on the situation. Listening to your body. I don't know about you, but I have a reaction, and I've begun to understand where it comes from, that about, it happens to me, usually not more than about two or three times a year, but I'll get in a situation, and sometimes I don't even understand what it is. I get this terrible pain in the middle of my chest. It's not my heart. It's just this terrible pain in the middle of my chest. And when I get it, I know something is wrong. And I have to sit down someplace and say, now, why did that happen? And it is always some anxiety that comes to me. And it usually has to do with the perception that I am out of control of a situation. It can be very benign, you know, but it's a, see, because that was very big, a big thing in my family, for my father as well.
To be in control.
To be in control. To be in control. And if you weren't to appear that you were, you know, well, that's the way I was taught and learned to function as well. And my body tells me when this is happening. I suspect all of you know certain things about how you react in moments like that. Watch the triangles you get in. If you know in a triangle, the person who is triangled, usually, who is pulled into a situation, usually takes all the stress for the problems that are happening between other people. You have two children who are fighting a lot, you know, and they both appeal to mom or to dad. Where's the stress? It's not in the kids. It's in mom or dad. Getting triangled in. Work out the balance between being responsible for self and being labeled obstreperous. I mean, sometimes you're responsible for self, you take a stand. Some people may say, you're just opting out. You're just being difficult. Come on. Come in and play the game with us here. But taking a stand is important. Keep the system loose through humor. Be playful. Now, I know that's not, you can't just say be playful. Things are really tense and you're uptight about a situation. But anything you can do to be playful and to maintain playful relationships with other members of your family, with other members of a work team, will reduce the anxiety and allow people to function better. Accept the possibility that one's own functioning might have brought on the anxiety. Maybe it's something that I did and not something someone else did to me. And that means that one can say, well, maybe I can influence a change here. Maybe it's been, maybe I've been contributing to this, and in what ways? And finally, I'd like to suggest what I've written on the board here, that there are always tensions for leadership, especially during crisis times. And it is the importance for leadership is maintaining a balance. It's not going over on one side or the other, but there'll always be this tension for parents in families, for pastors in congregations, for leaders in community organizations, for presidents of countries. The tension between leaning on others and staying accountable yourself for what's going on. The tension between being decisive and getting information. We've already talked about that. There's a point at which you need to be decisive. There's information that's needed as well. Keeping distance, an appropriate distance, so that you can understand and see what's going on, and yet staying connected, not cutting off, not moving entirely outside of the system. Don't avoid things and don't try to solve them. The tension between that. Keep a tension between continuing to function according to your vision and goals, and refrain from avoiding or denying what's going on in the family. In other words, you're not just overlooking that there's some issues here. Some things are going on. Commitment to see it through to the end, but not becoming the axis of life. Realizing that there are other people here with goals too. But still seeing things through in terms of how you see things. Being willing to risk and take chances, and yet regulate reactivity. Honor perversity. Honoring perversity means that you understand that there's going to be sabotage and things like that that happen. There's going to be reactivity. And not to react to other people's reactivity. Say, that's where they are now, and that's the way they're responding. It doesn't mean then to be reactive as well, but it means work at being objective in the face of that. Don't cut off, and appreciate the loneliness. It does get, leadership is lonely. It can be lonely in a family, particularly in a close family. Being a leader can get lonely because the rule is be together, be together. Stay in triangles. It's a basic building block for relationships. Stay in triangles, but don't get triangled. And take responsibility for the functioning of other people. I think that's it. Thank you very much. If you have other questions, I'd be happy to talk about it with you. I hope that you'll find and take a look at this book, or at Roberta Gilbert's Extraordinary Relationships, if you're interested in continuing to know more about family systems. It's something that people can do for themselves and their own families. I think it's a way of thinking and seeing and approaching life together. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.